We're now going to look at metaprograms. So if you could turn into workbooks to metaprograms. Should be just a few pages on from where you were yesterday. And I think you'll enjoy these. And I think you'll enjoy them because people like to categorize things. People like to know, I'm one of these and I'm one of those and that kind of stuff, which is kind of nice. And also, remember, these are generalizations and it's just a model. And I think it's also important for you to recognize with these metaprograms also that they are not dichotomous in that they're not one or the other. You want to think of them as a sliding scale. Yeah. So what did I mean? Well, let's have a look. Metaprograms, what are they? And why would you want to learn metaprograms? Metaprograms are content-free filters. Unlike values, where there's like events attached to and stuff like that, metaprograms tend to be content-free. And the big chunk is that metaprograms are a filter pattern that we have in how we process information, how we like to process information. Here's why you'd want to learn it. One, for yourself, to know how you prefer to process information so that you can order the way you do things in a way that fits your particular style of learning, one that fits your particular style of doing, so that you get the best result for you. Perhaps to expand your model of world and know there are other ways of processing information that might give you a richer model of the world. And of course, when working with other people, knowing how people process information means, again, we can, from a rapport point of view, start to structure how we deliver our information to people to get the best result. That could be very useful, for example, in managing staff, managing people, relationships, intimate or otherwise. Sales, definitely. For example, how to present a proposal so that it's more readily accepted. How to do your presentation so it's more readily accepted. Parenting, knowing what your children's metaprograms are, again, so you can understand sometimes when they're having difficulties at school doing a particular subject because of the way it's being taught. As a parent, you can then help them during their homework to do it, to show them how it would work in a different processing style so they understand it even better. There's a few examples of why you'd want to learn it. I think it's very, very valuable. And here's another example. Recruitment. You could, for example, if you're recruiting in a particular department, what you could do is you could elicit all the metaprograms of the top performers in your department. And then when you're interviewing, make sure that the people that you interview fit the same criteria of metaprograms as the people that are doing the best in your department. You're probably unlikely to get an exact fit on metaprograms, but there'll be certain metaprograms, for example, that are the really important ones for that department, for example, that make most sense. They definitely match. So there's another way, because training's one. Obviously I've been to training, obviously, but I tell you now, selection beats training every single time. So when you're recruiting people, it often, I did in the first place, made the mistake of just employing people because they were nice and don't worry, I can train them. No, it takes much longer. It's much better to find the right person first and make them even better. That makes much more sense. So let's have a look at, we've got, in metaprograms, we've got four basic metaprograms and then we've got complex metaprograms. Strictly speaking, the basic metaprograms aren't NLP. They come directly from Jung. Carl Jung. So let's have a look at the basic metaprograms first and have some quick discussion about that. So our basic metaprograms are firstly External behavior. So we're looking first at the person's external behavior. So that basically means doing. External behavior means doing outside yourself. Person doing. Is the person a doer who is more introverted in their style, or are they an extrovert? Oh, we got it on that side. Great. Introvert or extrovert? So introverted. I am an introvert. So that might confuse some people and think, hang on, no, he's very extrovert. No, I'm actually an introvert. I'm an introvert who's learned how to be an extrovert. Okay? So I switch on extrovertness when I train. But by nature, I'm more of an introvert, which means, we'll get to the questions on it in a minute to have you understand how someone is an introvert and extrovert. But basically, I like being on my own. I like my own company a lot, and I freak out when I don't have my own company. Whereas a lot of other people are the opposite. For example, they want to spend time with other people all the time. See, for example, once I finish the training, I'm all out. I'm basically all out of being with other people, which means, and these guys will experience that as well, because when I come off stage, for example, it's like I'm a completely different person suddenly for a while, because I just need to switch off. I'm all out of being out there. I've got to go back in here a bit. So rather than being out there, I want to be in here. That's more introverted behavior. Extroverts are quite the opposite and always want to be on the outside all the time and very rarely on the inside. So that's a more introvert, extrovert. We'll do some big chunks on this for the moment. Then look at internal process. Internal process. Is the person a sensor or an intuitor? A sensor, someone's more into facts, for example. They're more into being in the solid world outside. Whereas an intuitor tends to more like intuition, we're using their intuition more. They are using their gut feelings, things like that. Because they tend to go together. Intuitor and, or rather, internal process and internal state tend to go together as well. So if we then go into internal state, we look at thinking and feeling. Do you tend to be a thinker? So do you tend to use your reason and your logic, or do you tend to go with your feelings, for example, your gut instinct? I'm a feeler more than I am a thinker, which is weird because I'm an introvert. So there's no necessarily a correlation between these two. It just depends how you process. And then we've got a temporal operator, which is time, basically. And you've got judger or perceiver. And this comes on to like timelines that we were talking about earlier, Steve. From a timeline point of view, people tend to organize time in their head generally speaking, in one of two or three different ways. Every other way tends to be a variation on a theme. So let's just do that quickly now. So right now, as you think about it, if I were to ask you right now, instantaneously, to point in the direction of where you think the future is, point to that place now. Go for it. So we have some people different. So a lot of people pointing forward, some people pointing to the side, some people pointing up and forward. Yeah. Okay, good. So generally speaking, now, if I were now ask you to point in the direction of the past, to which direction would you point? Now, go. So we have some people pointing forwards for future and backwards for past. We have some people pointing this way for the past and this way for the future. So generally speaking, so there's a few variations on a theme, maybe slightly diagonal, for example, things like that, but they're variations on a theme. Basically speaking, if you have your timeline organized with the past behind you and the future in front of you, the next question to ask yourself, where is now? Point to where now is. Is any part of now, the only question really to ask is any part is now inside of you, or is it somewhere just in front of you, to the side of you, or whatever? That's the only real question at that point. So generally speaking, if you now draw a line between those three points, if you draw a line in your mind, that gives you your timeline. Now, human beings have to know how to store time inside of yourself. Otherwise, you wouldn't know if you were having a visualization of something, of whether it already happened or whether something hadn't happened yet. As in, was it a vision of the future or a memory of the past? You have to know in your head how to store that time, or you wouldn't know the difference. And this is useful because we're going to utilize this when we do the see meaning therapy process in terms of moving someone in their mind along the timeline, which is what you've been doing linguistically, obviously, with some of the patterns you've been using so far. So generally speaking, if your timeline is organized so that the future is in front of you, the past is behind you, we would call you someone who's called in time. You're an in-time person. And generally speaking, it means that you, is it, again, generalizations, as always, it generally means you're one of these people who are really good in the moment. But you're not that good at planning. You're kind of not as good at planning as you'd like to be. Those people who tend to have their time organized with, say, the past over there, future over there, or past over there, future over there, either way, doesn't matter. So the time is organized all out in front of you, so you can see it, past and future, then you would call someone a through-time person from a timeline point of view. And from a meta-programs point of view, generally speaking, if your timeline is organized this way, you're a perceiver. If your timeline's organized this way, you're a judger. So perceivers are the people that who really love the open loops, for example, in the metaphors. And the judges are the people that hate them because they want closure. They want closure on things. Everything has a right time and a right place. There's a right and a wrong. Whereas someone who's a perceiver that doesn't have much of right and wrong going on with them, their time, like everything, you know, it's almost like everything's flowing, everything's fluid, everything's moving, everything is the right place, right time, etc. Nothing's right or wrong, nothing's black or white, for example. They're more perceive it, for example. Like for me, I'm a really, really strong perceiver. So here's an example of that, of a behavior for a strong perceiver. I'm currently reading 7 books at the same time. Whereas judges can't do that. They have to read 1 book at a time. But I can do multiple things all at the same time. In fact, I get bored if I'm reading 1 thing at a time. So I tend to leave my options open rather than plan. So I tend to, like, you know, I don't want to leave my options open. I want to close things off. So someone asks me, what are you doing tomorrow, for example? I'll tell you what I'm doing tomorrow. This is why it infuriates my staff. Because they always want to know what I'm doing. And I don't decide what I'm doing until the next day normally. And then I decide. And I think it doesn't get right. I do visualize out into the future, but I still keep the options open even with the visualizations of the future. I don't want to set it as being one way. I want to see how I want it to be, but I don't want to make it too definite. I want to leave it with chance and options open, for example. Yeah, that's more a perceiver kind of behavior. Whereas a judger would be like, you know, a judger freaks out when you have a meeting with them and you're 1 minute late. If you're 1 minute late, you're late. Now, a perceiver goes, I'm on time. This is what freaks them out the back. I'm a perceiver. I finish at 8:30 when I'm supposed to finish at 8, and for me, that's on time. Because it's like, it's on time. It's not that bad. It's like, it's pretty much on time. It's 30 minutes. Now, for me, to be late would have to be 9. Now, for judges, 30 seconds over is late. That's just not late for me. It's not even in the ballpark. Yeah? Yes. As a generalization, yes. But pretty much. Yes, that's maybe true. So, but you may have one of these timelines that swaps around depending on the situation you're in. And that's good. Because you want to have, for example, you might find it useful to have through time when you're at work. But you might not want to live your life like that in terms of relationships, for example. You might want to change it, for example, so you're more in the now. So again, as a generalization, judger, slightly more dissociated. Perceiver, more in the moment, in the now, more associated. generally speaking, although sometimes head in the clouds if you go too far. Yeah. Yes, Andreas.
Yeah, I've done this sort of thing before, sort of Myers-Briggs.
Yes.
It's what's got me into NLP afterwards, started the process. What I found is when I went through the questions is you get like a percentage.
Yes.
Sort of what I found, I was very central in most of them, apart from very extrovert, and everything else I was very central. So sort of almost sort of 55, 45.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. The reference that Andreas is making to the Myers-Briggs is that Myers-Briggs is, it's also like a paper and pen instrument, for example, for knowing people's processing styles. Myers-Briggs is a much more detailed version of the metaprograms. The trouble with the Myers-Briggs, the difference with the Myers-Briggs is that you have to pay. There's like a license for every usage. For every time you use it, for example, you have to pay to use it, whereas this is free. There are, for every one question, there is for to determine what someone's metaprogram is. In Myers-Briggs, there's about 19 questions to determine. So it's more accurate, but it's longer, and it's not as easy, and you can't use them conversationally, the Myers-Briggs ones, whereas you can use these ones conversationally, so they tend to be more useful for you in terms of using them in everyday experience. Myers-Briggs would be better for you, for example, for recruitment, for example, things like that would definitely be a better instrument for you, but for your work, in terms of working with individuals and using your information, you're going to find this a bigger chunk and more easy. But it does mean you have got the slight danger of being inaccurate because you're only asking, generally speaking, one question for each metaprogram, which might mean the person answers it just because of the type of question. They may answer it in a different way just because of the type of question you've asked. So what I often do is I ask two or three questions because the questions we're going to give you are not an extensive list. You could ask other questions as well. Is that these are just examples of the questions you can ask to establish someone's metaprogram. Yeah. So let's have a look. Let's move on to looking at the questions now. Well, we've got the judger close there. Let's have a look at that briefly. The judger close. You have that there? Next page, I think, after that one. So here's an example of how to close in sales someone who's a judger. Because the most difficult thing to close is a perceiver, for obvious reasons, because they don't want to make a decision. But a judger is much easier to close because they want closure, so you can use it. So you say, Mr. Jones, you know there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything. And the right way to do or the right way to buy our training is da da da. And then you say to him, is firstly, we need to do a needs assessment of what, why would you need this? And then we need to do a proposal, giving you obviously, what's exactly involved here in the proposal, how we make this work. And then the third thing is to obviously for you to accept the proposal and pay. And you say, and then, of course, you can feel good about making the purchase. Then you say to him, so where do you think we are in the process right now? We've looked at your needs, and we've shown that this is something you want to do. I've given you the proposal, and I've given you the price. So, shall we go ahead? Because you basically set our parameters for them. You've got steps to follow, and they love steps. And basically then what happens is because the next step is to buy, they feel that they need to take the next step to buy because that's the next logical step. And if they walk away from it at this point without doing the last step, it feels incomplete, and they can't stand incompletion, so they have to complete it. Or they have to feel bad about it, as in when they walk away. So it's a kind of way of tying them up into a loop. It's a bit like, from the That's what it's for the judges in NLP. When I say, so there's four things that you need to really understand to be really, really outstanding in NLP. And then I tell you three of them. And everyone, see the fourth one, that person's like, what is the fourth thing? They're like, incomplete. And the thing about what you need to understand about something incomplete, something called the Zeigarnik effect, that says anything that's incomplete is infinitely more memorable than things that are complete. Because the human mind, it plays on the mind, if you like. And for a judger, even more so. Yeah? More so, yes. Yeah. But that'd be more, logic would be more like a thinker-feeler thing, rather than a judger. Because judge is about time, more than anything else. It's about time. Yeah. So let's have a look at that. That fits into our major elements of NLP. In the early days of NLP, we split up, you haven't got this in your workbooks. In the early days of NLP, it was split up this way. And we had external behavior, internal process, internal state, and then over time. That was developed later. To begin with, we just had this, we trained external behavior, what people do, internal process, how they think inside, and then state would be what's going on with their emotions. So let's look at that in a wider context. The internal state gives you the why. The external behavior gives you the what. And the internal process gives you the how. And over time gives us our what if. So let's fit in our categories now. From Myers-Briggs' point of view also, I guess. Okay, so our Myers-Briggs then from a Jung point of view. External behavior is our introvert-extrovert. Internal process gives us our sensor or intuitor. Our internal state is our thinker and feeler, and our overtime is our judger and perceiver. Since I know that I have an audience out there of a mixed bag of all of these people, my training is structured in such a way so as to, at some level, talk to you in your own processing style. Which is why I'm able to, I suppose, able to have a good rapport and everybody get to a certain level of learning and understanding, even though you all process things very differently. So, what do I do? Well, to begin, we said our why, our internal state, our why. Is that correct? So at the beginning of this section, what did I say? Firstly, I said, here's what we're going to learn. Big chunk, metaprograms. Here's why you'd want to learn it. You want to learn it because. Here's why. Unless I tell you why, you're not going to listen. Now, some of you miss it and you don't hear the why, or your why convincer's not filled up enough yet. So Simon, for example, occasionally doesn't get his why filled up enough. So he runs in his head, so what? As in, why would I want to do this? I don't understand how this works for me. Because he has such a big why, because he runs a big why in his life. He always wants to know why. And actually gets stuck sometimes there, true? So why is always covered first in my trainings. Whenever we do a new section or a new topic, I normally spend a few minutes on why. It doesn't have to be long, but a reasonable few minutes. And then we move into our what. What's the what? What do we say what is? External behavior. Yeah. So I then cover the what. The what is the big topic. So the what is the big chunk, the information. Yeah. So we give you lots of what. Then we move to this side, internal process, which is the how. Which bit's the how? The exercises, yes? So then you go out to the exercise and you do it. See, some people, you get the why done up, and then they have the what, but they still haven't got it yet. Some people who've got the what have got it fully. They fully understand it, and they don't need the exercise to actually get it. A lot of people do need the exercise to get it. So when you go out in the exercise, you do it. When you're doing the exercise, you're either sensing or intuiting. Whenever you're doing external behavior, the what, for example, when you're whatting it, you'll either do it in an introvert way or an extrovert way. When you're doing it in the real world out there, you either do things in an introverted way or an extroverted way. And then over time is our what if. What's the what if section? Question. Questions and answers. The Q&A section is your what if. And I don't know if you've noticed, but it's always the same people that keep asking the questions. Yeah? Because they're the what if people. That's me. I'm a what if person. Yeah? I always want to know what if. The what if people, if you don't allow in your trainings or in your communication with people, if you don't allow an opportunity for what if to happen, your trainings will go to pot, basically. You'll lose people. Because if their what if isn't filled up, they'll start to challenge you in the middle of your content. But provided they know that the what if bit's coming up, they wait. They understand. They sort of set up, for example. They know they're going to get an opportunity to speak. So they do, which means you can, order your training in such a way. So that's an example for you, just an example of how I would use meta programs to structure my training. And obviously, when you come to Trainers Training, or indeed on Master Speakers Academy, we will teach you how to do that, and you will be practicing doing that. And just that one thing alone, let alone the 20, 30, 40 other things we're going to teach you to do at a master's level, just that one thing alone can make your old presentations come to life, just doing that one thing. And you can do that, obviously, in just a normal conversation as well, just when you're speaking to people. It doesn't have to be a group of people. Just when you're speaking to one person, you could follow those steps, the why, the what, the how, what if. If you're selling an idea to someone, one-to-one, you want to sell a new idea to your boss, for example, here's how you do it. You say, look, here's why I think we could do this. Yeah? So you tell them all the reasons why. And then you go to, okay, so, and here's what it is. Here's what it would do for us, etc. Here's what the idea is. And here's how we could implement it. Go into the detail of how. Then you go to the what if. You go like, so what if we implemented this? What if we implement this? What would happen? Do, 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 do. And then next one would be, okay, like, what if we don't do it? Some negative motivation. What if we don't do it? What if we do do it? What if we don't do it? And that way, depending on the processing style of your manager, you've given the best possible presentation of your idea you could possibly ever have. And just having that structure in your mind will really useful for you in delivering information in the future, because you're using all four of the basic meta programs. And all of the complex meta programs we're going to look at next are effectively derivatives of the major four basic meta programs. Lucy.
Is there a link between whether you're a what-if person and the judger and perceiver? Because it's the what-if section, but I don't know whether there's a difference between, i.e., is Simon more likely to be a judger or perceiver, because he's, or whoever is the what-if here, more likely to be judger or perceiver?
It's truer to say, if we know what your four basic metaprograms are, we can probably predict what the other 19 are going to be, other 16 metaprograms are going to be. It's more difficult to predict if one you just have one basic metaprogram, what the others are. If we go back a step to looking back at the previous page in there, you've got a little organizational chart there that says organization of basic metaprograms. Judger or perceiver? Judger tends to be a thinker or a feeler. So when judging, do they judge by thinking or feeling? When they're perceiving, do they do it by sensing things? Sense is quite a confusing word here. Sense means solid. I use my senses, for example, solid. Things appear real, as opposed to perceiving, which is kind of like, just using, intuitiveness as well, yeah?
Well, the intuition's like the sixth sense, isn't it?
Yes, so correct, yeah. But I think the best thing to do is to do these meta programs and see how it comes out for you, because I have not found yet any direct correlation between how people do things. There are some sweeping generalizations, but there are also quite a lot of exceptions to the rule as well. There's some debate going on for me, actually, I think, about how people come to have certain metaprograms. We say that they're content-free. That's what NLP teaches. I'm not exactly sure if that's true. I don't think you're born a particular way. You may have, I don't know. This is the whole thing, isn't it? There's no argument about it. Are you born to have certain predisposition, or do you model it, for example? Is it because of simple rewards that you got early on and what you were noticed for that had you feel that way? You know, was it something you focused on that made you feel this way, that made you process in this way? Was it a shocking event that made you go into your shell, become more introvert? I don't know. There's all sorts of arguments about that. I don't really have an answer for that at the moment. I do know, though, that when, after having done work with people, for example, doing C-meaning therapy or change personal history, if you re-elicit some of the metaprograms, they do change. So it does tend to believe that at least some of them are indeed ones that are learnt as opposed to born with, if you like. Yeah. Good.
We were having a good discussion last night. Well, we've been educated about the female race, if you like. And I was just...
Was that a royal we there, isn't it?
Well, me and Steve. My key to... but what's coming up for me was, you know, there's a common thing that men are logical and women are emotional. Now, I don't want to offend anyone by saying that, but that's kind of a common thing. So what
get with your folks, and I don't want to offend anybody.
But what was going through my head was, is there a correlation between the sexes with these kind of categories?
Again, if we take in big generalisations, yes, we could certainly generalise that. Women are more emotional because they tend to be, and again, there's an argument about that as well, as in, how did that happen? Is it just because society sees it the way you've mentioned it, so therefore we actually end up manifesting it and actualizing it, or is it just that they tend to be born that way? There's probably some truth in both, in that ladies, for example, being you know, more nurturing by nature, because, you know, that's how we've been, you know, brought up. You know, ladies do, for example, give birth. Men don't. That's, you know, that's fact. So there they do tend to have a tendency, shall we say, to being more nurturing, which there means more emotional. I think the answer to all of that, if it's true, I think that is true. I think the answer is that the reason that men and women get together and have relationships is for both of them to teach the other one about part of themselves that's underdeveloped, so that you become more whole. And ultimately, you don't want to live, as I think Tony said as well, you want to develop both sides of yourselves, but ultimately you do want to live in your essence. And for a man to live in his essence, that would be normally more of a judger, not normally, as in like making it happen, doing this kind of thing. Whereas a lady, for example, is more into her emotions, for example, more feeling. And we're going to cover a bit of masculine, feminine energy stuff as well later in the week if we get time, because it's not part of the actual curriculum. But certainly if we have time, we will. But generally speaking, men and women get together because there's a part of them that's missing that completes them. Where you have problems in relationships is where both people are wearing masks. As in, the lady's truly feminine, but because of her adapted self has become more masculine because she wants to protect herself, for example. And, for example, the man is at his core masculine, but it's become quite effeminate because of who he's modelled, or maybe because of a fear, for example, of making decisions. Perhaps he was ridiculed a lot by his father, or maybe his mother, for example, was very, very intense, wore the trousers in the house, and his father was a bit sort of maybe dissociated, for example, went into his cave all the time, or was a bit of a wet dishcloth, for example, so he modelled his father in that way. That's when you start to have problems, because people aren't living in their true essence and being them true selves, and you end up attracting someone. If you're a man who is living in a feminine energy, you'll be attracted to a lady who's very strong, for example, if that's the right word, and very forceful, making decisions. But she may be doing that by wearing a mask as well. So what basically happens, you get into a relationship and both people are pretending, which is why a relationship doesn't really work very well. Where you then start to have even more challenges is no one's really feeling intimate in a relationship. There's no real polarity to give real kind of sexual drive and attraction. What you have is friendship at this point, no real attraction. And then what happens is it starts to get boring. And so one person wants to leave, for example, because there's no real stimulation in the relationship. Or maybe someone comes to a seminar like this and wants to change, and then of course it doesn't work anymore. You start to have conflict. So you either have to work through that conflict or leave the relationship, if that's easier or that's the decision you make, and then knowing what you know now, how different you are, you then go and manifest a different relationship with somebody else, remembering you learned something new rather than redoing the old behavior again with somebody new, which is what you would do if you just got bored. You just leave and then ultimately you just repeat the same pattern again. How many people have been guilty of doing that, by the way? Just show your hands if you've done that before. Yes. Good. So that's a more of an extensive answer to your question, but I don't know, just coming back to this essential question, which was, is there some direct relationship between masculine traits here and feminine? Yes, and that's a big generalisation. Yeah, yes. Yes.
I just loved it that you said the what if people get hooked up on, because I've been hooked up on a question I wanted to ask yesterday, and I went to university and it's like lectures, no questions, and that didn't suit me at all.
Yes.
I didn't do particularly well a lot of the time. So can I ask my question from yesterday?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, basically I was thinking about, like we were doing language patterns, and that we create pictures.
Yes.
Of the situation. So I was coaching someone, and I just wonder whether to create this picture of how I had been. And then I thought, I don't really like referring to that because I'm here and I'm now, and I don't want to do that. But then I remembered your brochures and your advertising materials. So it says Andy Harrington, I know, smoking, doing drugs, and I know what else, and a bit overweight. So
yeah.
My question was, how does that work for you, referring yourself back to a time when you weren't living in your essence?
Okay, good. So the question is, do I want to keep continually creating an internal representation of what I used to be like?
And whether I do as well, and whether it's useful.
So. Depends what meaning you attach to it. If the meaning you attach to that picture is that it makes you feel bad, then I wouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. Whenever I create a picture in my mind of what I used to be like, I feel great, because I remember that gives me a before and after of how far I've come, which has me have a reference of how much I'm growing consistently every single day. So it's just the meaning that you attach to it. Remember, a picture by itself has no meaning. You have to give it meaning based on how you process it, bring it closer, further away, the content in it, and what's actually in the picture itself, that gives it its meaning. So that's the only thing you need to do, is what meaning does it give to you? So if you want to do that, then give it a good meaning that has you, like me, that makes you feel good.
Thank you.
Sally. Dave the Rave.
Interested in something called human design, which is closely linked with astrology and astronomy. But what it does is you would need your time of birth and your place of birth. And there is a pattern for that individual when they take their first breath. There are 64 gates, there are the chakras, and depending on whether they're defined or not, gives you a personality, if you like. And you can lay one over another, and it will help you in terms of attraction. So perhaps what you've got, I haven't got, so I would look for it in you, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So, but I think there is a loose definition that you do have when you're born, in terms of a tendency to be one thing or another.
That's true. I think we do tend to have tendencies, and they either get explored or they get diminished, depending on environment and decisions and meanings that you create out of certain things. I think that's true.
Yeah.